Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
And welcome. You're tuned into the best in paranormal talk radio. This is Beyond the Darkness. This is part two of a very special tribute episode. Guy Lyon Playfair, one of the innovators in paranormal investigating and poltergeist phenomena, passed away on April 8th. We are playing the rest of the interview that we did with him a few years back in its entirety. On the first part back on Monday, we played The Anatomy of a Poltergeist, discussing his work in the field of poltergeist research. For the remainder of this show, we're going to be talking about the Enfield poltergeist case, which was featured prominently in the Conjuring 2 movie. So, without further ado, please help us remember a real forerunner in the field of paranormal investigating, Mr. Guy Lyon Playfair, in this, a repeat of the Enfield poltergeist case.
Good evening. Welcome back. This is the best in paranormal talk radio. Darkness Radio is on the air this evening. Our guest is Guy Lyon Playfair. His book, This House is Haunted, The True Story of the Enfield Poltergeist, which is reported to be one of the most definitive stories of the entire Enfield poltergeist case. It's one of the most definitive investigations and research, and we're lucky enough to have Guy Lyon Playfair as our guest this evening joining us. As we started off the first hour, Tim, we were discussing the fact that the Conjuring movie starring Patrick Wilson and Farmiga, Vera Farmiga, was such a huge success and a great scary movie, a great psychological thriller. They're now coming out with the sequel, which is entitled The Conjuring 2, The Enfield Poltergeist. But I've gotten these strange conflicting stories that Ed was the only one involved in the case, and it was very briefly, for just a few moments, literally like a day or two, and as more a consultant. And Lorraine had nothing to do with the case to know this was definitely one of their cases. So that was part of what drove me into wanting this interview, just an interest in trying to understand where do the Warrens play in on this case, or do they have nothing to do with it other than maybe a phone call or a conversation. Were you able to find any of the information online?
I can't find any comment from Ed or Lorraine on that particular case whatsoever. I'm still looking.
And look, check on YouTube during the break if you can.
I am.
To see if there's any of the audio, because I thought there was audio available, and maybe you can even just look up Enfield Poltergeist audio or case and see if anything pops up. Mr. Playfair, I'm sure you're familiar with Ed and Lorraine Warren and their research and work. Have they ever worked along with the Society for Psychical Research?
No. I bumped into Ed Warren once or twice and Lorraine, and I got the impression that Ed Warren was, fill in your own expletive. I wasn't impressed at all. Lorraine is still living, so I'm refrain from commenting on her, but she was very quite pleasant when I met her. They did turn up once, I think, at Enfield, and all I can remember is Ed Warren telling me that he could make a lot of money for me out of it. So I thought, well, that's all I need to know from you, and I got myself out of his way as soon as I could. I'm afraid I was not impressed, and he didn't spend I don't think he went there more than once, and I did read somewhere a transcript of a lengthy interview which he's alleged to have had with one of the girls, which they couldn't remember giving him. And it was describing all sorts of marvelous wonders, which I don't think ever happened. I think he was complete, fill in whatever word.
Understand. Okay, so you don't feel that, and especially in the interactions you had with him, you don't feel that maybe they had the best intentions when it came to the investigations of these cases?
No, they just wanted to make money out of it.
Okay. Have you heard, or in your research, have you come across any proof that Ed or Lorraine Warren had anything to do with consulting or being a part of this investigation?
Certainly not. Nobody ever mentioned him. I mean, I don't think anybody in the family had ever heard of him until he turned up uninvited. And,
so he just came out?
Who he was, and he didn't come again, and then we just sort of forgot about him.
So he came out to the site uninvited and just showed up to try to insert himself into the story, is what you maintain?
That's what I remember, yes.
Okay, fascinating.
It was quite brief. I mean, it was just one. We had so many people coming and going. I mean, I remember one day he did turn up. I think Lorraine was there as well. I'd also met them in Brazil. They sort of pop up all over the place. And it was just no big deal at all. I mean, I had a brief conversation with Ed at Enfield, and as I say, he was telling me how much money he'd help me make, and I politely declined his help and explained that that's not what we were mainly for in the FBR. And that was the last time I saw him.
Wow, what a that's kind of a disheartening idea. It'll be interesting to see how they put him into a movie and center an entire movie around it when he had no real hand in the investigation itself. So we'll keep it on.
No, absolutely not. He was I think he was just trying to cash in on it.
All right. Talk to me about this case. When you came in to investigate it, how long had it already been taking place?
About a week. I think it was, it started in the week of it actually started the day before that lecture at the SBR. So I would have been there within roughly a week of its onset. And my colleague, Maurice Gross, was 2 days earlier. He got there on the, I think, 3 days after it began. Because it appeared in a popular newspaper. We learned about it from the Daily Mirror tabloid, which is one of the more responsible tabloids, and they did a very good story, very accurate. They didn't make anything up at all. It was well done. And they had the decency to try to help the family, and they were the people who called the SBR, in fact, not the family. It was the Daily Mirror.
So you were there within a week, and what at the time you interjected into the story were inserted into the story, what type of phenomena had already taken place, rather?
Well, the first night was quite an active one because it started with knocking on the wall of the wall dividing the house with the semi-detached house next door. So the neighbors heard it as well. And they came around and tried to look for a normal source, rat or stowaway or whatever, and they couldn't find any normal explanation. And it got worse, and then the furniture started sliding around. The chest of drawers slid across the room, which really scared the hell out of them, and they called the police. Which is really all you can do if you're in that particular situation. And the police were very helpful, but they said that nobody was breaking the law and they couldn't really arrest a poltergeist because they couldn't see it. So they...
Now, did the police witness any of this activity for themselves, or were they...
Yes, they did.
Okay.
There was a police woman constable who saw a chair sliding along the floor, and she actually signed a written statement for Maurice Gross, calmly asked her to write out a statement, which to my surprise, rather, she did. And she stuck to it ever since, although she got a lot of sort of comments from her colleagues, but she hasn't retracted it at all. And a couple of other police officers also witnessed minor incidents. So that was the first night. That was a pretty good start to have the police testify to having seen something they couldn't explain.
Right. And when you've got the police involved in that, it certainly does lend quite a bit of credibility to the idea there's something more going on. The police were not dismissive of it at that time?
Not in the least. No, they were very helpful. We were lucky because the London police can be a bit rough at times, but I think when they're dealing with the less fortunate people, the sort of welfare people, they do tend to be rather more rather kinder to them. And we had another what we call the lollipop lady. That's the woman who stops traffic to let children cross the road to school. They're known as lollipop ladies in London because they carry these big sort of things that look rather like giant lollipops.
Right.
And she was standing right across the road from the house, and she saw one of the girls levitating up and down and gave the most meticulous description of it. And we worked out that she must have been at least 2.5 feet off the bed, which was not a bed that you could bounce on. It didn't have soft springs. It was hard. And I couldn't get 2 inches off it. I tried. And she said that Janet was up in the air and also floating around in a circle. It was like something out of the film of the Exorcist. It was very odd indeed. But she stuck to her story for years. She was frequently on the radio and television repeating it. And she never added to her original account. And she damn well saw that. And then, of course, we had another local tradesman who saw this large cushion appearing on the roof of the house between one frame and the next, as it were. Well, one moment it was not there, and the next minute it was. And there was nobody opening windows or throwing it or whatever. I mean, that was really one of the strangest things that happened. It just turned up.
Our guest this evening is Guy Lyon Playfair. He is a researcher and an investigator. And you said that you are the vice president of the Society of Cyclical Research as well. Is that correct?
I'm one of them. Yes.
Okay.
There's more than one. There's about four or five, I think. So I'm one of them.
When you heard about this type of activity taking place in this household, and you go there and you start to see these things, and these kids are talking about being thrown about, first of all, is there anything you can do to try to bring comfort to the family? And
yes. Oh, definitely. I mean, we consider ourselves to be kind of welfare workers, social workers, in partly because nobody else could do anything for them. They'd been to their local vicar at church, who came and threw some holy water around, which didn't have any effect at all. And they'd called in a medium who was not much use, and the police had been unable to really do anything except just be kind to them. And the newspaper had got its story and gone away, so they were left on their own, and they didn't have anybody ready to help them at all except us. So we felt we had to stay there until it stopped, which we did. And
when you go in and you realize
that my book was written immediately after I got back from each visit to the house. I went there roughly 100 times, and I would come home sometimes in the early morning, having spent the night there, and I would immediately type up my notes and do a kind of a draft so that I wouldn't forget anything that I just witnessed. So every word in my book comes off tape recordings made at the time. I didn't make anything up at all. I didn't have to.
Fantastic. An immediate diary and journal that was being maintained so that you could keep fresh and up-to-date information. You are dealing with this. Had the family ever experienced anything of a psychic nature or any kind of paranormal activity ever before this, leading up to this situation?
No, there was talk about some kind of experiments with a Ouija board, which don't really seem to have gone anywhere. I mean, I think they just mentioned that because they thought it might be relevant, but I don't think it was, and it was several months before the poltergeist got started, so that may be a false alarm. But otherwise, no, they were a pretty normal family.
And then one night it just triggers with the bangs and the knocks and then things being moved about, thrown about. You're brought in within a week of this case kind of taking off. And talk again, is you're taking the journals as it occurs on the spot and watching what is happening. You know, you see a family that's, I'm sure, frightened, uncomfortable now in their own home. The psychics haven't helped them. Clergy have not helped them. What can be done to comfort this family and make them feel like their lives are not in jeopardy or, you know, immediate danger?
Well, the first thing was to tell them that they were not the only people in the world who had been through the same experience, which they didn't know. They thought it was just them. And that is always a great comfort. It's not like going to your doctor with a pain in the stomach and being told that that's a well-known condition and it's something that your doctor knows about, and it's not just you. And in the case of the poltergeist, they'd never heard the word before, and the girls kept referring to poltergeist, which I thought was rather charming, and they referred to it as poltergeist from then on. And they simply hadn't the faintest idea what it was, and they never had any experience of anything like that. And it was the time when the film of The Exorcist had just come out, but they were underage, and they wouldn't have been able to see it. And it was never shown on television, as far as I know. So it came as a total surprise, and they hadn't any idea that anything similar had ever happened to anybody else. So the first thing we did was to say, you know, it's like a sort of passing dose of the flu or a cold or something, and it will pass, and usually they're all over within a month, which they usually are, but not always. And don't panic, you know, and that did seem to help.
And you said
Maurice Gross was a really excellent social worker. He looked after the family. They always had top priority, and he was very good at battling with the press and sort of awkward people and getting rid of people we didn't want in the house and that sort of thing. So that was our main concern, really, was to keep the family going normally.
The family is, you know, again, you said this really seems to center around the one girl, and almost to the point when you can pinpoint when she began her menstruation cycle, her first one. Is that right? Was it her first time of having her period that this kicked off?
No, that was about 2 months later.
Oh, okay.
The action started at the end of August, and the first period, I think, was early in December. So it was quite a while later.
All right, but she was coming into that stage. Her body was making the changes and transitions as this was obviously prepping for it. Was any of the other family members immediately affected? You know, was anyone else being touched or manipulated, moved, anything like that? Or was it always just when this one girl was around?
No, the older sister had sort of minor attacks. She was a year older. And she'd already been through her period. she did have a sort of a very, very minor version of problems that her younger sister were having, and also the brother, the 7-year-old. He had one or two isolated cases, but the great majority of the incidents revolved around Janet, the second daughter, who was 11 when problems began. And She's still around in her 40s. So,
and do you keep in touch with members of the family about the case?
No, we don't do that because we don't want to make them dependent.
Sure.
And we also don't want to implant the idea that it might start up again, which Janet was very scared of for quite a long time after it ended. She was convinced it was going to start again, and we said, no, it won't. And if it does, we'll come back, and if it doesn't, we won't. So we gave them every possible motivation to have it stop, and it has stopped. I mean, there hasn't been any action since. The last I saw Janet a few years ago when we appeared together on a rather dreadful TV program and had a long talk with her, and she'd had absolutely no trouble at all.
Well, that's good to hear.
Years or so since the end of the case. And also, I'm quite sure if she did, she'd be on the phone to tell me about it.
Now, with your research and the people involved with the society, do you incorporate the psychological aspect? Do you bring in people that can evaluate the members of the family to see if they're dealing with a case of multiple personality disorder, any kind of psychotic breaks, any kind of depression, things along that nature?
Well, we do what we can. We don't have the kind of funds that enable us to hire especially consultants for £100 an hour. We did have a very skilled hypnotist who was one of our members, the late Dr. Ian Fletcher, who had a fascinating session with Janet under hypnosis. That was very interesting, and I've printed the entire transcript in the book. And we had a a psychiatrist who had the girl taken into the Institute of Psychiatry in South London, which is one of the world's centres of excellence for neuropsychiatry studies of normal brains. And she was kept there for about a month, and they couldn't find anything wrong with her at all. So, yes, we certainly tried to get professional help.
While she was there.
Doctors and psychologists, you tell them you've got a poltergeist, they'll just sort of laugh and go away.
Exactly. When she was being...
Lucky. Yes, we did. We did everything we could think of.
When she was being evaluated at the hospital, was there activity that followed her to the hospital?
Not much. There were sort of minor anomalies which we couldn't really follow up because apart from our colleague, member who worked there, the other doctors were not in the least interested and didn't really want to talk about it. And also, we could only go there as visitors, members of the public. We didn't have any sort of status, and we couldn't investigate thoroughly as we'd like to have. But we did talk to some of the other children in the ward. And they seem to get on very well with Janet, and that probably helped because they were all sort of playing around together as young children tend to do.
Would the activity at home subside when Janet was not there?
Not entirely, no. There were small incidents. It was all very confusing because the first rule, if you get infected by a poltergeist, the first rule is to break up the family. You know, if there are children involved, separate them and send them all to stay a couple of days with somebody else if you can. And that's what we did. We did get them. Luckily, the girl's uncle lived just down the road. Poor fellow, he frequently had to take one or the other of them in just to break up the current, as it were. And we tried that, and sometimes we had things happening in both houses at once. One particular evening, I remember when I was rushing between one house and the other, and there were things happening in both. So they can they can latch themselves onto more than one person. Definitely.
Were you seeing corroborating evidence at both locations? Was the same thing happening at House A as was taking place at House B, or were they totally different phenomena?
Gosh, well, it was such a chaotic evening. I can't quite. It was nearly 40 years ago, and I think that particular night it was mainly rather trivial stuff like drawers opening on their own, which is a common trick of poltergeists. They like doing that. Sometimes they pull them out and dump everything on the floor. That's another favorite. And throwing slippers and shoes around and small things. We were quite satisfied that there were phenomena taking place in both houses at the same time, definitely.
The book is called This House is Haunted. Our author and researcher, Guy Lyon Playfair, who wrote this book as the entire story was unfolding. This was all from his documents, from his recordings, his journals, as it took place. This isn't something that took place in 1977 and he sat down in 2011 to write and had nothing to but memories to go back on, which I think is an important part of the case because memories can be shifted, tainted, and certainly changed. You went directly from the information that you garnered at those at that time, correct?
Yes, I started writing it about a week after I went there. I initially didn't really intend to write a book. I just intended to write a report to the SBR. And when that reached, I think, 75 pages, I thought, well, why not turn this into a book? Because I couldn't do any work. I couldn't make any income while I was following this case. So I thought, well, I got to do something to keep myself alive. So it ended up eventually becoming a book, but not to start with.
As you're putting this together and gathering the information to report back in this book, and you're having these this opportunity to go back, and you're listening to your recordings, would you find any strange anomalies on the recordings while you were doing it at the time that you weren't aware of when it originally took place?
Not that I can remember. No, we managed to record just about everything that we heard at the house. It was mostly pretty loud noises, so you can't go wrong there. And I did a couple of recordings actually, pressing the microphone against the floor and hearing knocking that you couldn't hear from the room. That was quite interesting, suggesting that the knocking comes from inside the floor, which is a very common observation. It does appear that that whatever it is gets inside the wall, and you don't hear the knocking unless you go down and get on the floor and put your ear on the floorboards, and then you hear it. That's very hard to explain, and it's certainly something you can't possibly fake. You can't imitate that.
And there's no natural type of occurrence that would make that happen. There's house settling or underground tectonic plates, any kind of shifting, things like that?
Well, I know what settlement cracks sound like because I worked in my first job was actually in the building trade, and I had to deal with settlement cracks after 7 or 8 months. You always get them, but they don't go on all night. You tend to get one, and then they stop. And you also don't get knocking, which responds to questions that you ask it. You say sort of one for no and two for yes or whatever, and you get replies.
And when you were getting replies, were you asking questions that you already knew the answers to, or were you getting replies that then you would go research and find out that you were getting accurate information?
Well, we got a certain amount of information that we couldn't verify because we would ask the thing how long ago it had lived in the house, and we got about 50 raps. But of course, we don't know who lived in the house 50 years ago. It wasn't even built. It was built roughly 30 years before we got there. But as far as we know, the rapper might have been just having us on or making it up. It's impossible to verify, so we didn't really take it too seriously. So on the whole, no, we didn't get any useful information out of knocking.
So it is definitely a case of, although you'd say it's an intelligent haunting in a sense because it's responding, you weren't getting any kind of corroborative evidence from the responses that you would get.
No, we didn't. But as I say, I did frequently have the impression that there was a definite intelligence at work, and because of the extraordinary precision of the objects that were thrown. I mean, they would very seldom hit anybody. And they would also have a obsession with balancing things on tops of doors. That was a standard poltergeist prank. Sometimes so finely balanced that when you just touch them, they'd fall off. And it was all rather silly and sort of childish, but it was something that the children did, in fact, try to imitate, but they couldn't do it. So on the whole, no, we didn't get any useful, exciting information out of the...
Is that frustrating as a researcher, then? You feel like, wow, look, okay, we're getting some kind of responses, but then you find out that it's nothing. Again, it just seems to be kind of chaotic energy that's being expended.
Yes. Well, there were exceptions. When we started getting the voice, this extraordinary bass voice coming out of the 11-year-old Janet's mouth, that was really when things got rather serious. And we did get this remarkable message from a man calling himself Bill Wilkins, that he'd gone blind and that he'd died in the armchair downstairs and he'd had a hemorrhage. And we didn't know anything about him at the time, but we later found out that that was all true. The previous occupant was named Bill Wilkins and he had had a hemorrhage and he died in the chair downstairs. And we also asked Janet casually if she knew what a hemorrhage was, and she didn't. She never heard the word. So that was curious. I mean, that did rather imply that we were in touch with a dead person, because nobody else in the house knew anything about this man.
So in that event, then, it does seem that it was more like a haunting, as we said, and not just PK or an energy expansion. It was definitely seeming to define itself more as a true haunting.
Well, I think a haunting, it rather implies something lasting quite a long time with the same entity doing the haunting, which is not the case here. I think it was rather more like if you remember in that film of Ghosts with Whoopi Goldberg, where they all queue up behind her, like
right.
For a telephone, you know. So
ghosts are an opportunist. They saw an opportunity, somebody was listening, so they came forward.
I think it could be, you know, they took advantage of a channel being open, because they can't communicate on their own. They don't speak in a completely empty house. They have to have a human telephone, if you like. That's the impression I had. I mean, it may be a very incomplete theory, but it's something that did strike us at the time now and then we did get information which the children could not have known.
Mr. Playfair, you said that Janet would speak in these voices. And again, this was hot on the heels of the movie The Exorcist, where Linda Blair's character Reagan would, this beautiful little genteel girl, would come out with these horrific voices and dark barking. And I know you said she was not familiar with it and hadn't seen the movie. But children talk in school. I remember I was only 10 years old at the time The Exorcist came out. And I remember my dad trying to scare me with the creepy voices. And I remember seeing the commercials on television at the time. So even though I was not immersed in it and I didn't watch it for myself, I was part of the lexicon and the pop culture at the moment. So I was not ignorant to the entire thing as well, is I guess what I'm trying to say. Could there be any fact that she saw any of this or heard from her friends at school?
No, because in the 70s they were quite strict about ages of film viewers, And the Exorcist was not shown on television, and she could never have got into a cinema. They wouldn't let her in. And the older girl did see the film many years later, and she thought it was all quite familiar, and pointed out that they hadn't had any green slime running down the walls. They'd had everything else. So The Exorcist was, of course, based on a real case involving a boy, not a girl.
Right.
But they definitely never saw it, and Janet, I'm pretty sure, never has seen it, and certainly wouldn't want to. So that kind of influenced them in any way.
All right, I was just clearing that up because, as you mentioned, there were these voices that would come from her. Would any other physical changes occur? Would her eyes roll back as though she was in a seizure of some sort? Would they change? Would her physical appearance differ at all when these voices would come from her?
No. Sometimes certainly on one occasion we did record what sounded like a voice when her mouth was shut, closed, and also when she had a mouthful of water. That was curious. But physical changes, we did record we had a very confusing period where Janet appeared to be in a state of kind of possession. I mean, she just didn't know who she was, and she was that was when there were signs of epileptic trance. I mean, she was sort of thrashing around on the bed and had to be held down by three of us, and was showing quite extraordinary strength. And that was really very, very that was the worst part of the whole case, because we tried everything. Somebody didn't know what to do. We had to call a doctor who gave her a very strong dose of Valium. And the only effect that had is that an hour later she was thrown out of bed across the room. And luckily then I happened to bump into a couple of Brazilian mediums who were visiting London and persuaded them to come up. And they put a stop to it immediately. It was most impressive.
How did they put a stop to that?
Well, apparently by not doing anything at all. I mean, there's a lot of anti-climaxes in this story, because one of them didn't speak English very well, and the other one luckily did. And they went through a kind of ritual from the cardiac spiritist principle of not so much exorcism, but intercession, you know, persuading the invading entity just to go away and go towards the light, as they put it. And it may be a load of nonsense, but it does work. And that was extremely impressive, because when they'd finished doing their thing, Janet went to sleep, and she stayed asleep for 14 hours, which is quite hard to do, I would have thought, 14 hours.
Right.
And that was well documented, both ends. I was there, the beginning and the end. And that was really very, very interesting indeed, extraordinary.
Were there any other physical markings on her, scratches, you know, anything that you guys could see that looked as though there was some kind of conflict or abuse taking place to her from this spiritual entity?
Oh, no, nothing like that. No, I've seen marks on other cases. One particular one in London where I watched a young teenage girl getting scratched on her arms and legs, and I actually photographed the scratches as they happened. I mean, I saw them appear. And that was very odd, and that's been widely reported. I mean, there's a whole book by an Austrian researcher from the 19th century called Oesterreich, who wrote a whole book about this kind of thing, and he described several cases where young girls have spoken in the voices of old men. It's a recognized feature of the poltergeist syndrome, in fact.
Now, Tim, were you able to acquire any of the audio at all for this?
Yeah, I've got a little bit of audio.
Okay, now this is actual recordings from the Enfield poltergeist case, some of the recordings that took place, and we'll go ahead and cue them up. Tim, is there any intro or anything we need to know about this segment, or is this just...
No, it pretty much rolls like an EVP session.
Okay, so. All right.
Now, if you squeak the bed, I can't hear you talking. Now, say Dr. Belloff. Come on. Come on, say it for me, Dr. Belloff.
And the researcher seems to be baiting or telling the spirit or the manifestation what to say in that, and we hear the voice. Tim, can you play that voice again one more time, the little segment? We're just listening to audio clips from the original Enfield Poltergeist recording sessions. Go ahead, Tim, have you got that?
Now, if you squeak the bed, I can't hear you talking. Now, say Dr. Belloff. Come on. Come on, say it for me, Dr. Belloff.
Dr. Belloff.
And that is a pretty deep, dark little voice coming out of a little girl. And it looks like it was calling for Dr. Bello or something. Does that make sense to you?
Oh, that one, yes. That was actually the first night the voice appeared. When John Belloff, and then parapsychologist from Edinburgh, he'd come down to visit the house, and that was the first night that we had this mysterious voice. So he heard it first,
All right. Well, and I think we've got one more little slice we'll play here again, real quickly. Go ahead, Tim. Now, Tim, I can't hear it very clearly, but is that when he's talking about when he used to live there? Is that what it sounds like the audio is saying?
It sounds like it might be, yeah.
Okay. Is there any... Now, you're looking at a video.
There's
it just
no
the audio, though?
Yeah.
Okay. Is it a video itself or just the audio translation?
Just the audio.
That is... Boy, that's a chilling voice to hear come from a little girl, isn't it?
Is that the one where she's talking about, my name is Bill Haylock, and I come from Durance Park, Grace, that one?
That's what it sounds like. It's very hard to hear through the system we have here. That's how we're going to place it. Was that what she was saying, Tim? Did it sound like that to you? She was describing who she was? Yes. Okay. Yeah, it was that segment of the audio.
Yeah, that was one of the longest sort of sentences we got from the voice, and sounded like a completely different personality to the usual one. That was an interesting one. Yes.
We have to take our top of the hour break, and Mr. Playfair is kind enough to agree to stay with us for a little bit longer, as we've still got some more to speak about with this case and how it was finally resolved. What was the aftermath of this case, and are there any commonalities in this case and other cases? Do any of these voices or these spirits reappear to the group that continues to investigate? We'll ask those questions and more. Stay tuned. You've got the best in paranormal talk radio right here. I'm Dave Schrader. That's Tim Dennison. This is Darkness Radio.
The following is an encore presentation of Beyond the Darkness.
Welcome back. This is the Best in Paranormal Talk Radio. Tonight, This House is Haunted, the true story of the Enfield poltergeist. Our guest for the evening, Guy Lyon Playfair, was born in India, educated in England, and obtained a degree in modern languages from Cambridge University. He then spent many years in Brazil as a freelance journalist and has worked writing many different books on these cases. First 12 books, The Flying Cow, in which he described his experiences investigating the psychic side of Brazil, was translated into 6 languages and became an international bestseller. His most recent book is Telepathy, and it's called The Twin Connection. He now lives in London and is a council member and a vice president of the Society for Psychical Research. Tonight we're talking about a book that covers the Enfield poltergeist case, and that case again taking place back in August of 1977, August 31st when it kicked off. And in totality, how long did this case take place?
14 months altogether. It finished in October of 78.
And different versions of these manifestations would occur. You'd have knockings, then you'd have moisture and water appearing. You'd have these voices. How long did the little girl Janet deal with the spirit of Bill trying to communicate through her? Was that a very short window during this investigation?
Yes, it was fairly short. That we had 2 or 3 messages, as it were, from Bill and other longer voices which sounded like a different speaker. I mean it was as I said before, it was rather like the spirits queuing up to talk through Whoopi Goldberg and as if they were waiting for a free telephone line.
Was there any message that Bill was trying to convey to you other than just that he used to live there and he died there? It seems like you get an opportunity to come through the veil and find this conduit to speak through. That's some of the most irrelevant information. I mean, it's good to have it to corroborate and prove that this person existed and did die in this house. But to what end? Was it, here's where the safety deposit key is, tell my children I love them? Was there any kind of meaningful conversation with this spirit?
Well, yeah, unfortunately, we researchers have to take what they're given. You know, we don't call the shots, and we can always try asking questions. We don't always get the answers. I mean, we have to.
Oh, and I understand
that. Yeah,
that
this voice is going to come through, and
right.
We recorded what it said, and I don't remember if we asked it any questions. We did try to check up that they existed. And one of them certainly did, and one of them didn't. So it's not a very reliable way of getting information about the afterlife, I'm afraid.
Right. I just didn't know if there was any of the messages that had any kind of substance to them, that like there was a reason these spirits hung around. You know, you would think that if I made it that far and I was able to communicate, I would hope that there was a reason for it, not just to say, hey, Dave Schrader checking in. I lived here and died here. Thank you, and have a good night. You know, it seems like it's such a waste from the other side that's all you give yourself.
I'm afraid it doesn't work that way.
Right.
I wish it did, but it doesn't. And I say we just have to take what we're given.
Exactly. All right. So this little girl deals with all of these different attributes, all the things that are going on through this. And how often are you and the research team there investigating? Is this a nightly thing, once a week? Once a month, how does it break down? I mean, that's a long time to have done it.
Well, in the initial, the first 3 months or so, it was every night, and quite a number of days. And we had the place under surveillance, as it were, because we had a neighbor, who had a telephone, which the family didn't have a phone, so the next door neighbor would call us if anything particularly exciting happened. And then when it started to quieten down in the new year, we'd check in at least once a week. And again, they would phone us if anything was particularly interesting. So we kept in touch until it just stopped in October of 1978 after the visit by a medium from the Netherlands. Dutch fellow called Dono, who was a tremendous anticlimax. He apparently did nothing at all and said that it had gone, and so it had. And that was the end of it. And not much, not a very exciting end to the book, but that's what happened.
Yeah, right. Well, but that's how it ends. And that's almost more terrifying because you don't know when it's going to start or how it ends. And there isn't some Hollywood ending of, you know, the medium coming in and purging the house. It just stops. And that's how things wrap up. When you...
They generally do.
Right.
The guys just go away. You know, they don't sort of end like a James Bond film or whatever. They just run out of steam and go away.
Was this a standalone home, or was it an adjoined home, or something?
Well, it's what we call semi-detached in English. It means it's two houses joined together, and with a sort of alleyway between them and the block next door. So they had one house directly sharing a party wall. And then a sort of alleyway between them and the next house.
And would you talk to the neighbors about what was going on? Were they reporting strange circumstances going on in their houses as well?
Not in the houses, but they certainly heard things coming through the wall. The walls were not terribly thick, and the people in the house next door certainly knew all about it from the very first day. And luckily, the next door neighbor was a professional builder, so he knew. What noises you find in houses when the beams are settling or whatever. And he was extremely helpful. He was first on the spot to try and look for the normal cause. And he kept in touch all the way through and was very helpful.
That must have been frustrating for them to hear all of that activity.
The memorable occasion when Janet claimed that she'd actually been through the wall herself. And they did find a book belonging to her in the house next door when the house was locked. And we never quite sorted that one out, but there's no doubt that the book was there, and there was nobody in the house.
Did she explain how she did it? Did she say she just, like Casper the Friendly Ghost, walked through the wall?
She was very confused by the whole incident and rather frightened. And we've got her on tape at the time, where she just goes completely quiet, and then you hear her sort of gasping and whimpering on the floor and unable to speak coherently. And then finally, interviewed by one of our colleagues who was there at the time, saying, I've been through the wall, just like that. And she was a very matter-of-fact girl. She tended to say exactly what happened and not ornamented in any way. I mean, she didn't make things up, I'm sure, because she always stuck to her story, and she just told the facts as simply as possible. And there's no doubt about the fact that the book that we'd all seen in her room turned up in the house next door. That is certain. Numerous witnesses to that incident, about seven, I think.
Now, did you mention earlier in hour one somebody was thrown through a wall, or was that what you were referring to now as her?
No, she wasn't thrown through the wall. She said our colleague David Robertson, who was a science student, actually, who was coming along to help, he'd asked her to try to, after this episode of a cushion turning up on the roof, he'd asked her to do that again and try to get it to go downstairs through the floor. It's a bit easier to control. And the next thing he knew was when he went out of the room and just left Janet alone, because things seemed to work better when she was on her own. And she went all quiet, and there was no sound at all coming from the bedroom. And then there was a kind of a thump. And she started sort of not quite crying, but making kind of whimpering noises. And David rushed in and found her in a state of absolute confusion and obviously very frightened. And she said to him, I've been through the wall. And she said that it was all white. There was no color, which is a very interesting observation, because I've about the same time I met Ingo Swann, who was one of the pioneers of the U.S. Stargate remote viewing program, who had a lot of experience with psychic phenomena of all kinds. And I mentioned that to him, and he said he had the same experience himself when he had a out-of-body experience when he was a young boy, and noticed that all the colors had gone pale, not quite vanished, but they'd been sort of drained. So I don't think you'd get... there's no way that the girl from Enfield would have known that, because Swann never actually published that. He told me himself. That was what scared her most. Not the fact that she'd been through the wall, but the fact that everything was all white and pale, which is very interesting. I've never come across that before.
Now, voices would be heard from her. Was she hearing voices that no one else could hear? Were things talking to her or trying to communicate with her?
I don't think so, no. No, we didn't get any spoken voices apart from these extraordinary noises that came through her, as if like an old man talking through
right.
her vocal folds. And we did record them with a thing called a laryngograph, and we established that she was not using her normal apparatus. She was using what is known as the false vocal folds, or plica ventricularis, which is what professional actors use to do growly sort of noises on TV commercials, you know, sort of thing, which you can't do for very long without getting one hell of a sore throat.
Right.
And yet Janet could keep it up for ages. And also I asked my own niece, who was the same age as Janet, if she could make the same noise herself, and she couldn't get anywhere near it.
Fascinating. What was going on in Janet's life during this? You know, schoolmates, this is in the news, being covered in the paparazzi. How is the family dealing with this acclaim and the people knowing that this is going on? Were they being ostracized, treated poorly?
It varied a lot, actually. They were very lucky that they lived quite a way out of town, as it were. I mean, they were actually not in Enfield at all. We rather used the word Enfield as a distraction. They were in the neighboring suburb of Brimsdown, which nobody's ever heard of. So we tend to refer to them as Enfield, and they had. As I say, their uncle lived two or three doors down the road, and they had very good relations with their immediate neighbors. So they were pretty well protected, and nobody would be very helpful to casual inquiries who just wanted to see something exciting. But in fact, it was so far out of town that not many strangers did turn up unless they knew where to go. In that respect, we were quite lucky, and the press in the 1970s was
respectful
compared to what they're like today, and also it was quite a way off the beaten track, so it was not it was not a problem really. The Daily Mirror story attracted a certain amount of interest in radio and TV. But we were very lucky. We never had a really bad time from the press at all. We were quite well treated by them. I think perhaps there's just too much evidence. They couldn't deny it all.
What occurred for this family once this subsided? Were they returned to normal? Did they face any kind of adversity or reoccurrences of this? Or has any of their children had any kind of activity take place?
I don't think so, no. It's been a very, very unfortunate family altogether, because the girl's parents were divorced in the same year that the troubles started, which may be a relevant factor. And then Janet's mother died fairly young. I think she was only in her early 60s. It was rather before her time. And one of Janet's children also died. So they've had a lot of tragedy in that family. It's really a very sad story indeed.
Do you look back at
Janet's brother also died? So they've had more than their fair share of unhappiness.
Do you look back at any of the recorded evidence, any of the things that you got? Does it look like any of the messages or anything that you got now, as you look back in hindsight at this case, was it maybe giving hints or precursors to these untimely and unnatural deaths for any of the family members?
No, I don't actually spend much time looking back on it at all. I mean, I'm quite glad to get rid of it. I'm doing a lot of other things. I'm much more interested in what I'm doing at the moment, which is investigating twins, who are a lot more peaceful. And I didn't get any kind of help from these various intrusions at Enfield. I'm afraid not.
We have very little time left together, and I appreciate your giving us an extra segment here this evening. For families that may be dealing with this in the United States or in other parts of the world where they don't have a team like yours that can investigate or research this, what are some of the best ways that you've found for families to deal with poltergeist or this type of activity?
Well, the first aid, as it were, is to separate the members of the family as much as you can. I mean, if there are only two children, just get one of them out of the house, or preferably both of them, to different houses. That's a sure way of stopping it. I mean, that has never failed. And also be very careful who you invite to come in who claims to be an exorcist, because very often they're not. I think I would certainly trust an established church minister who's not likely to misbehave if he comes from a recognized religion and not one of these sort of wacky ones. And also some spiritualist mediums are very well-intentioned and they have very high ethical standards and they won't misbehave. But the best recommendation is always a personal one. If you know, you start asking around locally, I would go to a spiritualist church, if there is one in the area, and just say, can they recommend a good medium? And you very soon find out who the good ones are, because they tend not to charge any money. The spiritualists are quite strict about that. The Brazilian mediums never charge anything.
How many cases of poltergeist?
That's one way of doing it, but it's very much a matter of chance. You can be lucky or you can be unlucky.
How many cases of poltergeist activity have you investigated?
Not all that many. I should think probably about 12, 15 or so altogether. Some of them are very, very brief, and some of them are quite long.
Have you seen ones that were more dramatic than the Enfield poltergeist case?
Well, some of the Brazilian ones are pretty exciting, yes. Luckily, I've already described those in my first book, The Flying Cow. And the interesting thing about the Brazilian ones is they were nearly all of them were quite nasty. They had sort of implications of black magic at work, which has never been the case in England. Quite different, and yet we had some really very unpleasant ones in Brazil, which I was very glad to see that we didn't have in Enfield, any sort of dead chickens with their heads cut off or anything like that. And ironically enough, it was a couple of Brazilian mediums who were very helpful in suppressing some of the most violent phenomena that we did get. But
how did that differ? I mean, when you talk about the violent phenomena, we talked about the fact in the Enfield case, Janet would sometimes be thrown about. Things would move on their own. Would move. What kind of things were happening in Brazil? Were they a lot more violent or a lot more impressive in nature for what kind of activity took place?
Yes, they tend to have a lot more fires in Brazil. We had outbreaks of fire in all the cases. that I did in Sao Paulo when I was living there, six of them. And one of them was actually witnessed by the local police who saw it happen and gave very good evidence, very good testimony. And we only had very minor fires at Enfield. They were all inside closed drawers, which is curious. And one of them actually burned a box of matches without setting fire to the matches, which is quite hard to do. But it sort of charred the outside of the actual box. And it also burned a £5 note, which is rather mean, because pounds in 1978 was quite a lot of money. And I still got the note. It was burned in half, sort of folded and burned on the edge so it couldn't be opened. I mean, it was burnt into two pieces.
Hmm. That would be the most of that type of phenomena. But you do find that spontaneous combustion is that always prevalent in most poltergeist cases as well?
It's very common, yes, very common indeed, and it can be totally destructive. We've had houses burned down in Brazil. Of course, it's always very hard to rule out normal fires, but you can rule them out when the local police chief actually sees them start, which has happened at least twice on cases that I'm familiar with in Brazil, where the police just happened to be passing at the time when trouble was beginning, and they were able to see a fire actually starting right in front of their noses. So that at least was good quality evidence. But yeah, yes, the fires are a problem, and we did have one particularly good one in London, in not far from Enfield actually, but a totally separate case, which was witnessed by the local fire brigade, who were called, and they also saw a fire starting, and said that they had absolutely no explanation, that they'd never seen anything like it before, and managed to put it out without any trouble. But yes, the fires are the most alarming feature of poltergeist, and I'm quite surprised that there haven't been more of them.
Have you ever encountered during these investigations something that you would, and I know you guys don't seem to like to compartmentalize or give a title to it, but have you come across things you would consider to be demonic in nature?
No, I don't have any time for demons, I'm afraid. I don't think that's very helpful, and I think it reminds me of Macbeth's remark, you know, that present fears are less than horrible imaginings. And I think he was right. I mean, I think Shakespeare knew a thing or two about poltergeists. Well, he doesn't say so explicitly, but there's quite a lot in Macbeth that rings fairly true. And it's certainly things that you might be imagining are much worse than what's actually happening. And if you're indoctrinated with all this sort of stuff about demons and devils, then you might very well get things happening which support that belief. But if you just don't talk about them and don't think about them, then they don't happen. We didn't have anything like that in Enfield. We did in Brazil, because that's very much part of the local folklore, as it were. But luckily, it's different here.
Do you believe that then that falls under things like tulpas, where it would be more thought forms and creations of our own design that we come across?
Oh, well, that's very, very possible. I am familiar with the idea of a tulpa from having read about it in Alexander David Neil's book. And I think the relation between thought and thinking and physical matter is becoming very, very much widely discussed by the physicists, more than by the psychical researchers. So that certainly is a line of...
No, it would make more sense, right, why some people are attacked by these type of entities as opposed to those. If your belief structure and understanding of what this is exists, of course you're going to see what you would derive to be a demon or an angel or a voodoo monster or whatever might be there.
Oh, yes. And you can make it worse by by your own belief system, and I think it may be that my own belief system is fairly skeptical, in the sense that I don't believe everything I'm told, and I don't believe everything I see until I'm sure I did see it. And I'm also well aware of any number of ways of trickery, and I've studied quite a lot of magic to know what to expect from a practiced magician. So I think I'm fairly hard to fool on a poltergeist case. I like to think I spot the real stuff. But there are some things that you cannot fake, as I've mentioned before. You can't fake that rapping noise where the waveform just does not look like any other percussive sound, and you can't do that unless you make it some other way. And that's the only way we know how to do it, is by hitting something which makes a certain pattern, and the poltergeist does it some other way which does not make that pattern, and you can't do that. You just can't do it. It's interesting, the fact that they look very much like the signatures of earthquakes, which of course come from inside the earth. As I've said, a lot of these poltergeist rapping noises seem to come from inside the walls and the floor rather than the surface. If you never get any vibrations, nothing vibrates during a poltergeist outburst. It is as if the noise is coming from inside the shelf or the wall or floorboards or whatever. And you just cannot do that. Sorry, I mean, you could not fake that without the most elaborate equipment and professional assistance and so on. And, it's just not reasonable to accuse relatively uninformed families of doing that. And also, why would they? I mean, what's the point?
You make a great point.
Gain much out of it.
The book is available, as is the first book that he wrote. We'll put links up to those on our website, links up to the Society for Cyclical Research. And I know that your newest book is about twin telepathy. And I would love for you to visit again with us in the future, sir, and talk about that topic if you'd like to rejoin us at some point.
Yes, certainly. I'm getting information regularly. I've had a number of fascinating cases just a few weeks ago from California. So it's getting nobody's ever bothered to do this before. I mean, actually go out and ask people, twins, if they've had any telepathic experiences, and sure enough, about one in three certainly has. And for some reason, nobody else has ever bothered to ask them.
Well, I would, if you're open to it, I would be happy to connect you with a pair of twins that we know that have attended many of our events, and they, I believe, would have some stories that might really fascinate you. So I'll talk to you about that off air and see if we connect you. But thank you so much for your time tonight, Mr. Playfair. It's been a pleasure talking with you and hearing your perspective on this case.
Oh, you're very welcome.
Hi, Dave and Tim. We're going to do a little parish here now, if you don't mind, Tim. Round out the last bit of the show.
All right.
You guys rock. You know, I picked this one, don't you?
Uh-huh.
Yeah, I always like a little ass kiss at the beginning.
Oh, yeah.
I love the new program format. Keep up the good work. My story begins. I was visiting my friend in Lemoore, California. My friend Jackie and her husband Josh, the names have been changed for their privacy, moved from San Francisco to Lemoore, California when Josh enlisted in the Navy. He was stationed at the Lemoore Naval Air Station. One weekend, I decided to visit and stay with Jackie and Josh while Josh was on duty at the Naval Air Station. They rented an old farmhouse on a piece of property no longer used for farming. We had a wonderful visit until the last night I was there. We were expecting Josh home later that evening, so we decided to sit in the kitchen to watch for him through the back door. Jackie and I were no strangers to the paranormal, so our conversation started in that direction. Jackie was telling me many of the paranormal happenings at the old farmhouse, such as when they were driving home from a weekend getaway in Yosemite and wishing that the old clawfoot tub wouldn't take 45 minutes to fill up with hot water. When they arrived home, Jackie went into the bathroom to start the bath, only to find the water was already filling the old clawfoot tub, and it was almost full. We next talked about her brother, David, who had recently passed away at the age of 19 from a tragic car accident. Growing up with David, I knew him very well, but we continued to talk about him. Things got very strange. Suddenly, all sounds in the farmhouse stopped. I mean, everything. The hum from the refrigerator stopped. The sound from the air conditioner stopped. The song on the radio stopped. Even though there was something eerie about that silence, we thought maybe it was a power outage. So I got up and turned on the kitchen sink faucet. There was no sound when the water hit the sink. Jackie opened the kitchen window, and there was no outside sounds, such as crickets or cars driving by on the roadway. At that point, we panicked. We grabbed our purses and started for the back door. When we opened it and stepped out of the farmhouse, we could hear sounds again. We could hear the crickets and the cars. We ran as fast as we could to the car, drove to the Naval Air Station, and sat outside waiting for Josh. As Josh drove us back to the farmhouse, we told him what had happened. He believed us and went into the farmhouse to check things out before Jackie and I re-entered. Everything was back to normal. A few years later, after Jackie and Josh moved, the old farmhouse was torn down by the owner. To this day, we really don't know what it was we encountered. I'm hoping both you, Tim, and your listeners may have some idea of what happened. Thanks, and that's from Elaine. Tim, would you like to weigh in on that? What do you think occurred?
Be hard for me to say, to be honest.
Yeah. There's so many options. You know, you're that close to a military base.
Right.
Could it be some kind of testing going on in the area? Mm-hmm. There is sound dampening equipment that exists.
Mm-hmm.
Could be that. Could be that, you know, there was something strange and paranormal. Could be aliens, as Giorgio Tsoukalos would tell us.
Well, yeah.
Yeah. I wish I had a better answer. I could make stuff up. I think I did.
Yeah.
That was definitely aliens or a Bigfoot or a Bigfoot alien.
Ooh.
Yeah, one of those.
I'd like to see one of those.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. That's what I thought. This is another Parashare story coming in for us right now, Tim.
Mm-hmm.
Hi, Dave and Tim. I have a ghost story from when I was a kid in Sheboygan, Wisconsin, which is between Green Bay and Milwaukee. Go Packers is what it says here.
Oh,
anyway,
no.
It was 1986, way back in 1986, Tim, and I was 8 years old. My dad and I were spending the summer watching this house out in the country for the summer while the owner was off at boot camp in the Navy. Another Navy story, Tim. Do you think that all of these stories are going to have something to do with seamen?
No comment.
All right. I'm just curious. It was an old farmhouse, and I stayed... Oh, another farmhouse. I stayed in a room upstairs while my dad stayed downstairs. There was another room upstairs that the door was always closed and always creeped me out. I was always afraid to look in there for some reason. I would hear knocks and laughs and other weird noises up there all the time. Okay, I've got to stop the story right there, Tim.
Okay.
He says very clearly,
yep,
that there was another room upstairs that the door was always closed and that creeped him out for some reason.
Okay.
Not sure why.
Mm-hmm.
He was always afraid to look in there for some reason.
Right.
Could the reasons be that you would hear knocks, laughs, and other weird noises?
Could be.
That might be enough for me.
Yeah.
I think mystery solved, mm-hmm. Scooby. Quick, on to the next mystery.
Yeah.
Yeah. My dad is a man's man. And would tell me to stop being scared. One day, I heard what sounded like a kid talking and running around. I finally got all the nerve an 8-year-old can get and opened the door I always avoided. Standing right in front of me, plain as day, was a child about 5 years old. We made eye contact for a few seconds, and I started to go downstairs to find my dad. When we got back up there a minute or two later, my annoyed dad looked around and said I must be seeing things. But that kid was plain as day to me and just stood there a few minutes earlier. I at first thought it was an actual child, but the house was in the middle of nowhere. And the closest house was an older couple, and there weren't any kids for a few miles at least. He didn't look misty like a stereotypical ghost. It was just like a kid standing there. And I never saw him again, but continued to get weird feelings and hear noises that entire summer. This event never left my mind. And about 15 years later, when I was in my early 20s, I did research on the property, and back in the 1920s, when it was still an active farm, a 6-year-old boy got caught in the combine by the barn and mangled to death. I have no doubt in my mind I saw the ghost of that child. Whenever I'm in that area, I'll go out of my way and then drive past that house, which is still there. And I wonder if that little boy is still in that room. I love your show. Listen to every episode on podcast. By far the best paranormal show I've heard. P.S. I'm sorry you've had such a bad football team.
I don't know about that, my friend.
NFC North Division champion.
Chris Bondi. Yeah. I don't know if you watch the game, but we're winners.
P.S. A little boy in that room wearing a Vikings jersey. Just thought I'd throw that at you.
We got to be careful because, you know, we're going to mess with the damn Packers again, and it's going to be ugly, Tim.
Oh, maybe.
Just a thought. All right. That's a good story, though. Kind of a creeper and a little kid ghost story. We, you know, we love kid ghost stories around here, Tim.
Oh, sure.
They're always chilling to the core. I thought I saw a poltergeist story here. Hold on a second. I'd like to read it if I can find it. Nope, I can't.
Hmm.
But I do have a black-eyed child story.
Ooh, we should probably...
But did I read this the other day? I felt like I read this one.
Hmm.
Let me open her up and see what we've got here for the audience, Tim, because I want to make sure it's the best. All right, here's one that's entitled, Tim, A Bone-Chilling True Story.
Hmm.
How about that special effect?
That was pretty good.
How much money did you spend on that one, Tim?
Exactly $32.50.
Wow, very good.
Yeah.
Hi, Dave and Tim. I've been an avid listener of the show for years now, and I think you're doing an excellent job along with Tim. Now, my story. I live alone and have been living alone for a few years now. I'm separated from my wife, who's made me believe in black magic, even though I refuse to believe in all of that. Well, last week, I went to the local supermarket to get some things. When I returned home about 10 p.m., the lights were off. Strange, because I left the lights on. I always leave the light on. Anyway, as I opened the front door to my house, I heard a little girl giggling. I thought nothing of it as I went into the kitchen to put the shopping away. What happened next will stay with me forever. So wait, you walk into your now darkened house and hear a little girl giggle and don't... Yeah, well, that's nothing.
Yeah, well, you know, could be the TV.
Here's the difference between me and this cat. I poop, drop the groceries, and burn the house down.
Well...
In that order. In that order,
might
son.
Might be an extreme reaction.
Well, you know, we all have our ways of dealing with stress, Tim.
Yeah.
Anyway, as I opened the door, the front door of the house, I heard the little girl giggling. I thought nothing of it as I went to the kitchen and put the shopping away. What happened next will stay with me forever. I walked into the living room and tried to turn the light on. From the corner of my eye, I saw someone sitting on the couch. I jumped in shock as I turned the light on. I couldn't believe my eyes. There was a man sitting on the sofa, rubbing his stomach and muttering things. Ah, that kind of stuff.
Oh, my.
Yeah. I was out of my house in a flash and called the police. I waited outside until the police got there. About an hour later, I found out that the guy on the sofa was homeless, and he used to live there 30 years ago. Now, I always think twice about going home alone. Hope you liked my little story. Take care and all the best, John. Yeah, see, it's those fleshies you have to be worried of, Tim. It's not the ghosts.
Right.
It's the fleshies.
The fleshies.
The creepers. The skin and bone brigade, if you will. That's what I like to call them.
I think I belong to them. They're a motorcycle gang.
The skin and bone brigade?
Yeah.
Yeah?
Mm-hmm.
Let's see here. We've got a Christmas story we didn't get to at Christmas time. Let's knock this out since we're still kind of in that area.
Yeah.
Hi, hope I have the right email. You do. Dear Dave, several years ago, my married brother moved all away from our small New England town to the arid air and cheaper homes of Arizona. He had lived there several years, and ultimately this was a sad move, and although he had medical issues, which he never told me because he didn't want to upset me, his marriage had broken down and he had lost his job. At a time when life was great for me, it was hard to hear this loneliness. He had so many physical issues. The weather was great, but all the warm days still could not keep you company. One day, about 3 months previous to his death, he held this grudge against God. He started to say, "I have something to say to you, and I don't want you to be upset." At the time, my husband and I became involved with church, and I made no secret that we had something special. "I don't believe in God. I guess I was thinking this is where it's going." He who had been a choir boy as a child, I quickly answered him, "That's okay. God loves you anyway." We never really spoke about it again. But he still knew that I did what I felt good within the church, and he was alone without the faith he had been brought up on, and didn't comfort him. About 4 days before Thanksgiving, I called and we chatted about cousins, aunts, and friends, and I made mention that the kids in the church are doing a pageant, and I was excited to see it. It's always adorable. We then continued on, and at a lull moment, he just said, "Well, I've been thinking about God. I'm not so angry and blaming him for handing me some tough times." My eyes filled with tears that he had something to grab onto. Before we said our goodbyes and
that I would call him at Christmas probably beforehand. Now, on December 5th, I got a call that my dear brother had, in fact, passed. I have to say that for all the years he was a non-believer, and this broke my heart, I was very sad. Our niece and I flew to Tucson to empty his apartment and arranged for a cremation. As we prepared to spread his ash or his body in both Arizona and New England, it was a hard week. I have to be honest, I worried about his soul. I had been brought up in a faith that you don't get those answers in the mortal world. That Christmas was a sad one, but we knew how I loved the season, and even when my dad died, when my mother and he decided to just forego Christmas decorations, but I was 18, and that was a holiday that my dad loved. So while my mother and brother were out, I took up the artificial tree and decorated it all on my own. We, as a family, always had a tree from then on. I know my father was always making memories, particularly for me. It was special. We, in my opinion, kept my father in our Christmas from that time on. So, after having my brother away in his new home in Arizona, my husband and I started to collect ornaments from all the trips we took. My brother, knowing this, would try to send an ornament every year for me from Arizona. The first ornament was a paper thin of tin. Was a paper thin of tin with cactus cut out, tilted to make it look like a snowflake. The ornament always handed well because it was it had already been bent. After that, we always put away the ornament deep into the tree, but still visible. On December 22nd, I was coming down the stairs, and in my grief, I prayed descending the stairs, "Lord, I know we should trust, but I really would like to know if my brother was allowed into the kingdom." After the last word, I heard his tinkling. I was sure it was the cat trying to get into the tree. As I walked around the room, I heard this tinkling noise, not his tinkling.
That would be awkward.
Totally different story.
Yeah.
Brother peeing on the tree. I was sure the cat was trying to get at the tree. As I walked around the rooms to the tree, I saw it. The tin cactus snow ornament was on the floor, not right at the base of the tree, as I had assumed, but all the way into the middle of the room. I stood there in shock. The ornament had to be unclipped from the tree and thrown to be where it was. No possible way it could have come down on its own. I started to cry. And in a hoarse whisper, I said an out loud thank you. Christmas was sad, but became bittersweet. I had an assurance that the link between this world and the next was a whole lot closer than I thought. I felt humbled by this affirmation. Be it my brother or God, someone was listening in my sorrowful statement. Yes, there are times of affirmation, times of faith, and times of comfort. I still miss my brother terribly, but I know he is waiting for me. When we meet again, we will never be separated. I know this is long. Edited it, Will. Too late, Ginny. We read the entire thing from Lowell, Massachusetts. So thank you very much for sharing that Christmas memory with us. Mm-hmm. I don't know if I've got another short little story in here.
We're kind of coming into this.
Real quick. I'm a lifelong abductee, and you just admitted it to himself about 7 years ago because I was so afraid. But now I actually have on more than one occasion got them to give me and my skeptic neighbor a light show, a blue and orange lights on the horizon, and they keep getting bigger. And I also had a UFO directly above my home that disappeared. And then I asked if they could show themselves again, and they did 4 more times. And those are just a few of my stories. I have many more. I would never lie about the subject. I've gotten nothing but ridicule.
Thank you all for joining us in this representation of the original interview we did with Guy Lyon Playfair a few years ago and his final appearance on Darkness Radio. We hope you enjoyed it, and he will always be in our memories as one of our all-time favorite guests. To honor him, make sure that you give a little more love this week. Hug your loved ones. Make that phone call. Say hi to somebody that you've been meaning to for a long time, because as we see on a regular basis, what we have can be taken away from us so quickly. It'd be a great remembrance for you and for the rest of the people listening to this show to make that stretch out and reconnect with somebody we've lost touch with. Have a great rest of the day. We'll be back with you on Friday with a brand new edition of Beyond the Darkness and a more haunting theater of the mind, right here on the best in paranormal talk radio. This is Beyond the Darkness.
Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen, brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
Tired of spills and stains on your sofa? WashableSofas.com has your back. Featuring the Anabay Collection, the only designer sofa that's machine washable inside and out, where designer quality meets budget-friendly prices. That's right, sofas start at just $699. Enjoy a no-risk experience with pet-friendly, stain-resistant, and changeable slip covers made with performance fabrics. Experience cloud-like comfort with high-resilience foam that's hypoallergenic and never needs fluffing. The sturdy steel frame ensures longevity, and the modular pieces can be rearranged anytime. Check out washablesofas.com and get up to 60% off your Anabay sofa, backed by a 30-day satisfaction guarantee. If you're not absolutely in love, send it back for a full refund. No return shipping or restocking fees. Every penny back. Upgrade now at washablesofas.com. Offers are subject to change and certain restrictions may apply.